primarily going to talk about what we do in my lab, but also a lot of the work that was before me and by some of my colleagues that are sitting here in the audience, so don't be surprised if you hear your name. I'm going to define seed quality just in case somebody here is not a seed scientist, although I see most of you are. And then I'm going to differentiate biotic and abiotic stresses. And then I'm going to relate those to the biology of the seeds and how seed quality and abiotic stresses interact with the genome of the plant to produce different seed qualities, regardless of what the environmental changes are going to be. And then relay that at the end just to leave you thinking about it with climate change and the things that they say the climate is going to do in the future. So, you know this one. I'm not going to even read it to you. It's very basic. And they're the means, of course, of passing heritable characteristics to the next generation of the offspring. Seed quality, by definition, in this particular presentation, and we know that many of us call seed quality different things, would be the physiological and the genetic characteristics of the seed that allow the uniform and rapid growth and development of the plant. So seed quality also affects the survival of the seed in storage and is influenced by things like genetics and seed composition. Then again, I'm not going to read this one, but I'm going to remind you that biotic stresses then are those that are related to other organisms that might attack the plant, and thus they will influence the seed quality, or abiotic stresses, environmental conditions that we cannot control. Seed aging, I put it into the abiotic stresses as a toss-up, really. It's more biological than it is. But the seeds, as they age, they have more stress in them that will create differences in quality. And then we have temperature, hail, salt, drought, heavy metals, wind, and soil pH, etc., etc. So all of these climatic conditions will affect the seed quality, and we're going to touch about, as I said, since some of us get here late, I'm going to touch on some of my colleague's work that he just walked in that has also given the base for some of the things that we do today. So the seed depends from the environment. And the plant for the beginning of the life, from the time of fertilization all the way to physiological maturity, and after that, the seed depends entirely on the environment. And the desiccation rate and everything that is going to happen in the field is going to depend on that environment and what the influence of that environment is. So water, temperature, soil nutrients, wind, and weather conditions. Drought is the number one, and as I said, I was going to mention some of the people that are here today on their research. Water stress creates in soybean, reduces the photosynthesis and the transpiration, reduces the seed weight, the yield, and increases the percentage of shriveled seeds. And those shriveled seeds have poor germination and poor vigor, and thus low seed quality, accumulate fewer storage proteins than a fully mature seed, and those soybeans also have a mineral composition that affects the seed quality. In corn, water at the late stages of vegetative growth or water stress will actually have problems in synchrony of flowering. And I'm going to show you a picture that I really think is very interesting. This is a year of hybrid corn, and it was only 10 centimeters. 10 centimeters is about 5 inches in length. This was a year of hybrid corn, on a year that we had rain all the way to fertilization and zero water for the next 45 days. So the plant was really determined to produce all these seeds, but then there was no water to move photosynthesis into the seeds, and this is the seed what happened. Millions of seeds. We really didn't lose that much yield that year, but the seeds were really tiny and seed quality was very poor. So the grain people didn't have any problem. The seed people had a lot of problems. This also has been proven in barley, and that's another colleague that I thought might be here today, but he's not. And he had problems of senescence or early senescence and the reduced seed yield that came with that. Seed water as the process of desiccation tolerance. If we remove the water fast, then we might have problems on seed quality. This has been proven in corn with artificial drying, but also with soybean. If we artificially dry soybeans inside a pod, even when we harvest them very, very green, we still get very good seed quality. But if we remove them from the pod and thus they dehydrate a lot faster, they're not ready or they haven't reached desiccation tolerance, and they will actually have very poor seed quality. So we have a couple of those. One is on the evolution of ethylene that shows that seeds are not mature and they are not ready for desiccation. And because they're not ready for desiccation, they really have problems of germination after dehydration. Defoliation is another form, basically, of having low photosynthetic products that are in the plant. Even though they're not quite drought, they're related in the type of stresses that we have. And we show that in sorghum, for example, you have we had stripped all the leaves of the plant at 50% anthesis, and what we saw is that the seeds that developed, we had a greater proportion of seeds with very low specific gravity and big areas of the endosperm that have not been completely filled with starch. And drought as another problem. We can actually have problems towards the end of maturation and desiccation in the plant. When the moisture content goes really, really low, first we do have a lot of mechanical damage, but also we observed individual injury at room temperature, which is always reported that cold water, when it's imbibed on a very dry seed, will actually create problems. We saw it in seeds that were imbibing at regular temperature. And what happened, we think, it was related to media, so it was an artifact. If the imbibition of that seed happened from one side with medias like, for example, Kimpac, that gives water only on one side, the seed started imbibing, what the other cotyledon remained really hard, and the torsions, the internal physical torsions of the seed actually cracked it in the test. And we had a very serious test condition. This actually happened in 2005 in Iowa. We had a very beautiful fall with wind and sunny days, and the plants were drying, and the seeds were drying a lot faster than the plants. And then when we brought them to the test, we will get really bad germination. But we were doing it in one media, and when we did it in a different media, the germinations all went up to 90%. So that's another thing that might change seed quality when it doesn't really change it completely, but it will alter the results that you get on the test. And I had this picture from a couple of summers ago in a cornfield right before physiological maturity. We had had lots and lots of rain. Then we had a dry period, and then we started having intense rains at harvest. And we saw a lot of these crackings of the pericarp. It was almost like my husband is here sitting in the audience, and he has a vineyard. And whenever this happens in grape production, people are really upset because they know the seed coats of the grapes are going to burst, and then they're going to have all kinds of problems. The same thing we're seeing in corn. We're seeing that the seeds after physiological maturity, if they don't have the black layer formation yet, they can reabsorb water and have the same symptoms. One that we probably should be looking at now. Temperatures, again, some of my colleagues in the audience did some of this research, how temperature influences seeds. What we know is that the seed quality is affected more by night temperatures than it is by day temperatures. But if you increase the temperatures during the growth period, then you're accelerating maturation, and that cannot be a problem depending. So when you have temperatures that are high at night, you can reduce germination and vigor. So night temperatures are the very problem for seeds. And several authors have done the same work, and they have found that vigor and germination have a sharp decline when the seeds develop and mature at very high night temperatures, and that night temperatures are more detrimental to seed quality than day temperatures. The same thing in rice, and also the fact that if the night temperatures are very high, some genetic lines, for example, the lines that are from warmer climates like Oryzia sativa cultivar indica, can have more tolerance to those hot temperatures during the night than something that is from a cooler climate like Oryzia sativa cultivar japonica. And some of the work we do in my lab is more related to early frost during the developmental stages in corn. We are in an area of the country where this can happen. Once every 5 to 7 years, we have an intense frost, a killer frost, right before physiological maturity. And things that we have learned is that the damage is going to be related to genetics, and it's more related to the maternal parent than it would be to the paternal parent, and that moisture content at harvest, of course, or at the time of the frost, is also very important, and seed composition is very important. We found that oily seeds have a little bit of a cushion on that temperature problem. And when you get the frost, if the seeds have higher oil content, they will have less damage than seeds that were more high in protein or starch. And this is one of the areas that were interesting to us, was that B73 is actually a Missouri line. Sorry, B73 is an Iowa line, and Missouri 17 is a Missouri line. And even though this is adapted to cooler temperatures, to warmer temperatures, when we had a physiological maturity, the frost effect, there was a lot more change in B73 from between the frost and the non-frost treatment than there were in Missouri 17. So basically what I'm trying to say is that seedling tolerance to cold temperatures during emergence do not have much of a relationship to cold tolerance to an early frost as a seed stage. So these two things must be regulated by different genes, and the fact that one line has more tolerance as a cold tolerance for emergence does not make it more tolerant to freezing. Soils, this is part of our research. We were trying to see if we increase phosphorus and potassium in the plant or in the soil, if the plant uptake and the seeds that we're producing in those fields will be higher quality and they will store more or for longer periods of time. And what we did find was that really they didn't do much for storage, but maybe a little bit for a short time in poor conditions of storage, but not in regular storage conditions. and that excessive levels of phosphorus and potassium actually could decrease these qualities. So there was a point where increasing phosphorus and potassium became toxic, phytotoxic, and the plant actually produced seeds that had lower quality than the ones at a normal level of phosphorus and potassium on the soil. Seed composition, again, that's intuitive. If you have high protein versus high oil, usually the high oil seeds will have more problems in seed quality than the high protein, or high protein lines will have higher quality. And that there is a big genotype by environment. We were trying with a colleague of mine to move lines that have been developed under conventional systems into the organic systems and see if the quality was going to remain the same. The good news was, yes, the quality remained the same, but she worked with different seed composition lines. And actually, the lines that were developed under conventional environments and moved to organic environments came up with higher oil content than the same line produced under conventional systems. And protein content was not affected then by the environment where these plants were grown, at least between the organic and the conventional system. We have some wind research too. When we're trying to contain pollen in corn, we were trying to see, everybody was looking at grain and contamination, and we were trying to look at seeds also and contamination. And when we held everything else constant, this is a couple of models that a colleague of mine in meteorology, which was one of the collaborators, did. So this is the windrows for 2003. We were in the middle of a city of Ankeny so that we will have no other corn. That was the only way in Iowa that you can produce a field of corn and not have other corn around. So we actually had houses and neighborhoods. And we were trying to fix everything and just see the effect of detasseling in a field. And so the amount of pollen is the same. We had a central field with yellow pollen. And then everything else was white corn. And we detasseled one field, and we did not detassel the other one. And then we looked at the contamination levels or the outcrossing levels in that field. And this field was surrounded by 200 meters, just that's the norm for the production of certified corn. You have to be 2 meters away from any other corn, 220 meters actually, because it's 660 feet. So what we found was what we suspected. Basically, the pollen can travel. If you have a very heavy pollen cloud that is a local pollen, then your outcross is not going to go very far, or at least it's not going to affect much of your corn field. But if you have more outside corn or outside from the central field coming into the other corn that was detasseled, then your concentration of outcrossing is going to be a lot bigger. So seed fields have bigger problems with pollen flow than grain fields. And this is just showing two grain fields in two different years. So now we leave the experiment of non-detasseling as the fixed factor, and we're trying to see those things, how the environmental conditions will affect them. And of course, windrows, and I learned this from my colleagues, this means that the predominant winds or the faster winds were coming from the north west into the field, and some from the southwest. And so you see this is the design that the pollen flow does, actually following how the windrow was pretty much. This one is even closer to the windrow. And the last project we're working now, or not last, but this one is like a long life process. I don't know how or when we're going to ever finish it, but we're trying to see how stress alters the seed, not only as a phenotypic characteristics of the seed, but also at the genotypic characteristics of the seed. So we're based on, we know what adaptation is. Oh, nice. Doesn't want to go the other way. There we go. So we are trying to look at the gradual changes that happens in adaptation, and can these changes happen a little bit faster. So since Sabri is standing up, I'm going to just hop off of a bunch of the introduction and show you that what we were trying to do is really, really stress the plant. For some reason, and there was in the literature by other colleagues of ours, that if you separate the plants, we've been breeding soybean for a very long time to be growing in rows, and now we separate them and we give them all this land and sun and everything else around them, no competition, that really stresses the plant. And of course, the life of a seed scientist, we had a hail on top of that. So it just pulverized the poor plants, but some of them actually survived, and they produced seed. And we're still, this was in 2007, we're still, what, 10 years later, still looking at some of the variation that we found after we harvest those plants. It was really crazy. We found things that abortion of seeds, different color plants, these two are really different pubescence plants in the same row after we harvest them from one plant that was totally isolated. We plant them on the row and we started looking at the changes. One of the things we followed was aconitase, because one of my colleagues in this project had done lots and lots of work on aconitase enzyme, which is a Krebs cycle enzyme. And of course we had so many different stresses. We're trying to separate all those stresses. We're still trying to separate the effect of honeycomb from hail, which was something that happened that we couldn't separate. But what we saw is that when the stress was mild, then we had mild phenotypic and genotypic changes. But when the stress was really, really intense, then we had huge genotypic changes. Deletions, insertions, now we're trying to figure out if some of those are transposable elements. We found phenotypic changes that I'm just going to show you some of the pictures. Lodging, pubescence color, maturity, and how many seeds per pod. I mean, the plants really went berserk. And we're still cleaning up and trying to find some of these things, and this is what I mean when I talk about insertions. And I don't think, this one is a deletion here, two deletions. So new pieces of DNA are popping in those plants. A lot of the things that we saw were primitive. The plant went back to primitive traits like shattering and the types of pubescence and the fact that we found a lot of yellow lethal and yellow viable mutants. Some of those are in papers if you're interested in reading. The yellow lethal paper, yellow viables, the genetic mapping of the aconitase gene. And this is my collaborator that I really miss. He passed away a couple of years ago, Reed Palmer. And then Davinder, as a geneticist that we work with, and he did a lot of the mapping work for us. Of course, you can't do this with tons and tons of graduate students, undergraduate students, other collaborators, and so thank you to everybody. And what we can say is that there are phenotypics and genotypic variation on the parent plant after subjecting them to an environmental stimuli. The stronger the environmental stimuli, the bigger that is. And that seed composition and seed quality vary also on the environment that the plants are grown, and that reflects on the seed and the seed quality. And that the genetic changes originating from environmental stimuli can be stable and heritable. And I'm going to go to this that I really wanted to make you think about. Climate change, I'm going to give you the one before. Some of the things that are going to happen are that we're going to need a bigger gene pool and more information on that gene pool to be able to handle a lot of these changes that we're expecting. Tons and tons of literature reviews. So.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.